Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During this edition of the show, we give you access to local physicians and public health experts with information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
Good morning. This is going to be a technical challenge this morning. I'm sorry about that, but it is Wednesday. It's time for Doc of the Rock. Things are sort of heating up a little bit in town. 36 new cases reported to the borough yesterday, with more moderate increases with community transmission and close contacts and a few travel-related cases. Case count associated with the borough is now up to 340, with 104 cases active. 14 individuals completed isolation, been removed. Sorry. So we are into another edition of Doc of the Rock with today all of our guests not in the studio on a variety of platforms, and we're having some difficulties. We're just going to have to try and struggle through. Dr. Evan Jones, I can see you. So, morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, there you go. And Dr. Curtis Morrison, you're on the line as well, right?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Okay. As usual, we will take questions. If you have any, shoot us an email or give us a call. We'll try and get the question to one of these doctors. Dr. Jones, let's start with you. How are things going in the last week? We're post-Thanksgiving now. We're in a position where, you know, it's the surge before the surge, apparently. That's how it's been characterized by Dr. Fauci. Numbers keep increasing in Kodiak. How are things from your perspective going?
Not horribly unexpected at this point. I feel like I think it's kind of to be expected after this holiday that people are coming home, and a lot of people kind of waited the weekend to get tested. So it's not a huge surprise to me that we did get a bit of a bump because people both delayed testing and they were traveling and coming home after being on holiday. So we definitely got a bump yesterday, but not wholly unexpected. It just means that we do need to be more vigilant. It is in the community. It is fairly moving through fairly strongly. In the past, these have all been ones that were brought in and we're able to stop them right there. Now we're having a lot of close contacts coming in, and who are a lot of close contacts of people who came back with it are getting infected. So be extra vigilant. We're seeing more hospitalizations and more here in the clinic also.
Dr. Mortensen, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, okay. I'll echo kind of what Dr. Jones said, which is, you know, we actually did at the clinic, at the community health center on Monday, we did 92 tests and 17 of them were positive. And so that's a positivity rate about 18%, which is, you know, quite high. And that just means that there's a lot more cases out there that haven't been tested. And it is obviously very, very concerning.
And you unfortunately find yourself in a situation where now you're in quarantine, right? Well, this was my worst fear, you know, that was been a kind of a joy that we've gotten to this point of being able to do these small groups throughout this whole ordeal, to where now we're into the Zoom meeting version of the Doc of the Rock, and we're running into technical problems for some reason. It hasn't happened before, but I apologize for it. It would be nice to have you all in here, but unfortunately, it's not something we can do right now.
I think that some of the numbers that we're getting reported, even though they're high, probably underrepresented at this point. I think that the numbers are actually much higher, because I know families who one of the family members is sick, and then there's three other in the household who've not been tested, but they have symptoms. So they're just hunkering down, kind of knowing that they have it. And so even though we see a high number, it's probably significantly higher than what we're even seeing. And I've actually talked to several patients who have gone through being infected with coronavirus, and they had mandatory testing, and they never had any symptoms and nothing that would have brought their attention to it. So it's here, and it's probably much higher than what we're reporting. So that's why I just tell people, be careful, be thoughtful about what you're doing and what situations you're putting yourself into.
Well, it appears at the state level, they know they're actually reporting the fact that it is way underreported, because they're so short-staffed that they're trying to catch up to be able to input the data. Then you have issues like what happened in the Mat-Su with labs that weren't reporting, so they found an extra 1,600 cases that were reported. And from my understanding of the way that this is being addressed on even a local level, that is what's happening. People that have symptoms aren't actually coming in to get tested. They're being told, just assume you already have it. But doesn't that sort of make the number lower than it should be? You know, without the documentation that this person actually
does. Yeah, it's a tough balance, because we are reaching the point. Yeah, I agree that it is definitely underreporting it. There's people who we don't know that they actually have it. We're just assuming they are. They've made the decisions that they don't want to get tested at this point, and they just are treating it like they are infected. And it's a tough balance, because this is going to come into play with, in the future, with who gets immunizations, who do we need to contact, because it's really difficult to nail down when that person actually got infected. So who do we need to contact in their social circle? We've kind of asked patients not only do we rely on public health to contact people, but we've asked individual patients to contact their close contacts, to try to keep it as simple as possible.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about what it means. Dr. Mortensen, are you online right now? Well, even it looks like it's just me and you again, unfortunately. But I don't know. well, we'll see if they join us as we go along. Yeah. If you can you again go through what isolation versus quarantine means? You know, there are different rules for what you would do if you're...
Yeah, and even depending on where you're at, if you're on base and you test positive, they take it pretty serious, and they don't even want you leaving the house. I think it means different things to different people. And so for me, if you're a positive, you really should be around no other people, not even to get groceries with a mask on or anything like that. If you've tested positive, there should be 2 weeks where you are completely isolated from non-positive people. I'm not going to tell you that you can never leave your house and go exercise, but you should be avoiding people. If you're driving a car, it should be by yourself. There really shouldn't be anyone else that you're around while you are quarantining.
Dr. Mortensen, welcome. Thanks for plodding through.
Well, I can hear you pretty well now, so that's great.
Okay. You're quarantined now.
Correct.
Talk to me a little bit about the healthcare and health. Of the numbers that we do know, we now have seen over 2 weeks from Dr. Theobald last week to you this week, even though she had the virus. Are we getting to a point where we're starting to get concerned about our healthcare providers in this community having shortages?
Well, I don't think that, you know, we're at like a critical level right at the moment, but it's really easy to see how quickly that can change in a setting
like this, where there's limited medical professional. And if you're looking at having, you know, if you have an exposure within your clinic, specifically like a staff member who then is a close contact to multiple other staff members, you can see very quickly how if you have to put a bunch of people out for 14 days, 10 or 14 days, that can have significant impacts on staffing very quickly.
So
and the hospital is experiencing this to a certain extent. A lot of the reason we're at level red, a lot of the reason we're at the red level at the hospital is because we simply don't have enough staffing at times. It's hard to find enough nursing to cover everything.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion throughout the state in the last week about how Anchorage is getting so close to being overloaded. The talk has been among those healthcare professionals how there aren't enough people to go around. Do we see that same type of thing happening at a local level, or do we still have enough capacity to meet the demand and, you know, what the demand might be to 2 weeks from now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely we're starting to see some of the effects of that staffing on here locally. And certainly I think even to a greater degree in a place like Anchorage, which will be concerning to us very quickly because that is our primary referral spot. You know, if we have a really sick patient, they will typically we've sent those patients to Anchorage. So if there's not enough staffing or availability in Anchorage, then that poses a significant issue for us.
Well, with as much transmission as there is locally, the questions that keeps coming up now are related to good best practices for people when you're exposed to somebody who has the virus. And now we have new CDC recommendations for quarantine that just came out today in regards to how long you should be quarantined and in what circumstances you can reduce that down below. From my understanding, the local medical providers are the people that are giving information to people as to what to do. You know, this is what you should do if you have a positive test, or this is what you should do if you have a close contact with somebody who was positive. Is that correct? I mean, are you the go-to place for passing out information, and who's responsible for doing that in each of your organizations?
I can take that one, even if you're okay with that. So what happened, you know, kind of between March till about a month and a half ago is that public health has been the primary source for that. As far as for doing the contact tracing, providing education on what isolation or quarantining and how much time that would be. And then eventually clearing people from isolation or quarantine. They've been involved in that kind of pretty extensively. They were involved specifically with all cases that were confirmed positive. As of the last month and a half or so, because of the rising cases, public health has been unable to keep up with the amount of contact tracing, with the education needed to provide to patients. And so we as local clinics have taken sort of on that responsibility of connecting with patients, giving them education. The recommendations we're providing are from the CDC. You know, and the CDC guidance is that if you are a confirmed positive case of COVID-19, then you need to isolate for 10 days. They're very clear on that. And then before you can clear from isolation, it has to be 10 days since either your symptoms started, or if you're asymptomatic, then 10 days from the positive test. So that's the general rule for isolation. For quarantining, so this is somebody who is a close contact, the recommendation recommendation from the CDC would be that close contact quarantine for 14 days. That intuitively doesn't make much sense because you think, well, the person with the actual coronavirus has to isolate for less days than somebody who's a close contact. It makes sense from the standpoint of the person that actually tested positive for coronavirus is earlier or is later in that disease process. And so they are further along in the process, so they don't have to isolate for as long as someone who's a close contact.
Have they changed at all? I mean, how does it work in the clinic for people who want information about that? Do they actually have to come in to the clinic if they have questions about this? If they were in close contact with someone, and there's no testing involved, how does the information get passed on to the person? I mean, I mean, it seems like your front desk has got to be swarmed with calls constantly.
Yeah, it's a big problem right now. We don't have enough staff to cover the number of phone calls that we're getting. And it's been a source of frustration for our typical patients that they can never get anyone when they call our main number, because we have so many staff dedicated to answering questions and even just scheduling people to get COVID tests. And we're trying to figure out how we can get a few more people just to, now that we're having more and more positive tests, people have questions when they're positive, and it takes more than the 30 seconds of saying you're positive, so go ahead and isolate at this point. All that takes a little bit of time. We don't even have enough nursing staff to do that. So we're looking to expand the number of people we have working towards that, but it takes away people who had been doing regular healthcare. And so it's a little frustrating to all our patients to not be able to speak to a live person very quickly. People are having to leave messages and we get back to them as soon as we can, but it has been a frustrating process.
So we've actually, with people, we were struggling with the same things, and how we've kind of determined just for our clinic policy is that basically every patient that has a positive test for COVID, we are pretty much defaulting to scheduling them for a telemedicine visit with a provider. And that way, that provider can go through, first of all, they can make sure the patient is feeling okay and you know, educate them on what to expect and what symptoms to look for. Also educate them on what they should do. What does isolation mean? How many days they need to do that? And then also help that patient sort of identify who might be a close contact, so that they can reach out to those close contacts. I will also state that there's a few really good handouts, and I can even provide them for you, Mike, if you want to post them to the website or something. A few great handouts from the state of Alaska that go over this. There's one handout that is how to clear someone from isolation, and it has to go through very, very specifically what that means. Additionally, there's a handout that talks about what to do as you're waiting for your test result. And it goes through the result, like what happens if it's positive, if it's negative. So I can certainly give you links to those handouts. Basically what we do is our telehealth providers go through that with patients and they give them the hyperlink to those handouts so they can have something to review as well.
Right. You mentioned something clearing, Curtis, before about the public health's role previously, which has now kind of defaulted to the local providers. It does seem like in the governor's health mandate 8 about traveling, that there needs to be, if somebody has a positive case, that there has to be a medical clearance at some point before they're supposedly allowed to travel. I mean, are you folks actually issuing medical clearances to people who've recovered from COVID?
So that's a kind of a sticky issue. So what we do, and this is pointed out in the state this handout from the state of Alaska, is what it basically says is, I as the medical provider am not necessarily writing that you're cleared from COVID, but what the state form says is that basically the patient signs it and says, I affirm that these things are true, that I had a positive COVID test on this day, that my symptoms started on this day, and 10 days have passed. I have isolated for that time, and therefore I can be cleared from isolation. So it's essentially a little bit on the patient's honor system. We would never be able to keep up with writing notes for every single patient to clear them for work or whatever for these different things. And so we're really trying to stay out of the business of writing work notes, because first of all, it's not, you know, it's a thankless job. Second of all, it's really fraught with a lot of issues for us to do that. So what we do is we do tell people what is required of them based on CDC guidance, but really it's kind of up to them and their employers to decide what to do with that information. But the CDC does have great information on their website that goes through all this. The state of Alaska does too. So there's some pretty clear recommendations.
Well, Curtis, one of the things that keeps coming up now with more of this increasing in our community is, well, how do you deal with this if you're in close or somewhat close contact with it? And now you're sort of in a unique position to be able to actually give some people some advice on, all right, here I am. I'm in quarantine for 14 days. How do I deal with the people that I love? How do I live in a house, you know, without affecting the people in my household?
Sure. So, you know, I think that, I'm on the video here. So we've kind of transferred our guest bedroom into a makeshift office. And so, this is going to be kind of my workspace, here. One thing we did as a family is we kind of decided, we said, okay, there's two options for this. Since I'm a close contact, I don't actually have the virus, at least not to my knowledge, but I'm considered a close contact. We kind of made a decision that either I'm going to isolate away or quarantine away from everybody, including my own household, or we as a household are just going to quarantine away from basically the rest of society, essentially. And what we decided is just for our family, it was going to be easier for us, probably a wiser choice for us to quarantine as a full family, as our just general family, away from everybody else in the community. And so that's us. That's what we decided. And so basically what that looks like for us is I'm going to be working from home. You know, we are going to be doing, you know, no activities with other family members or friends, for the next 2 weeks. We'll be, you know, if we need groceries, we'll either be doing the drive-in, takeout groceries. We won't be going to restaurants, obviously. You know, just kind of the things to basically, we are going to not be close contacts with anybody outside of our nuclear family.
That's probably a good way to deal with it. Yeah, that's one of those decisions you kind of have to make. I mean, if you're in a decision in a different environment and you don't want to potentially expose everybody in the whole house, you have to treat things a little bit differently and try and do that isolated bathroom and clean up and not share common space. But it might be more livable like that.
Yeah. And if I actually had coronavirus and so I was actually isolating, we would not do this. Like if we were isolating, I would kind of confine myself to this downstairs bedroom and not be around, you know, the rest of my family. That would have been a no-brainer. But since I'm a close contact, you know, I think that it's not an unreasonable decision to do it this way. But, you know, everybody has to make their own decisions in that regard.
Did you have a good idea of, well, let's put it this way. You probably take all these extra precautions at your job anyway, so that you sort of have to treat everybody as if they had COVID, right? I mean, so even if you're in close proximity to somebody for more than 15 minutes and you have your mask on and you've been washing your hands and you're taking all the precautions, I mean, does it become less probable for you then that you actually have contracted it just because you were in proximity? I mean, does that inform your decision about, you know, the possibility?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, sure. Yeah, and I think, you know, in our office, we do universal masking of both patients and all staff members. We try to do things that you know, allow for us not to be close contact. We try and space out our staff members. We, you know, you can try and minimize time in the room with patients, although that's challenging. You know, I think that the likelihood is decreased by the fact that we're doing all those things. But they, again, kind of coming back to what the CDC recommendations are, is that even if we have everybody masking, if you're within 6 feet for 15 minutes of a patient with confirmed COVID, then, you know, that's got to be considered a close contact. And when we go close contacts, go back 2 days from the time of the positive test or 2 days prior to symptoms starting. And so, you know, sometimes you don't know until after. And so I think that it is an important reminder that, it, you know, to do all the things we can to try and minimize these close contacts. And some of the ways we're trying to do that, I just explained, but some of them are, we're really going to be pushing, I think, and I think even can speak to this from Canna's perspective, but we're really pushing telemedicine right now, because if anything can be done telemedicine, then that is going to eliminate the risk of exposures. Not everything can be seen by telemedicine, however, so that creates the other challenges.
We are mainly switching to telemedicine at this point. Even my patients, who are typically very against telemedicine, they want to see me in person, have been encouraged to switch over to either VTCs, a video teleconference, or by telephone. We have, I've upped my game a little bit. I was wearing a surgical mask while seeing patients. I've elected to start wearing an N95 mask for all patient visits. And there's a couple reasons for that. I think there's patients who are scared to admit that they have COVID symptoms. And so even though they get double screened before they even enter the building and they're wearing a mask, it's still, people want to, are in a little bit of denial that they have symptoms. And people are, a lot of people just don't have symptoms. And so they don't even realize that they're carrying COVID. Because of that, I've elected to be wearing I wear an N95 for every patient encounter. I still wear a surgical mask while I'm in like Safeway or Walmart. But in the patient visits, I am using a higher level of masks than I was before, especially now that it's getting more widespread.
Got a question from a listener about how long does a contact take to catch the virus?
I guess I'll go on that one. The close contact definition is someone who has been within 6 feet of a person with confirmed COVID for 15 minutes within a 24-hour period. Now, that's a definition that's been made based on different studies that increase probability of catching the virus. We all know that it's possible to catch the virus if somebody coughs on you once and they're, you know, perhaps not within that amount of space. But I think that the probability of somebody obtaining or being infected with coronavirus goes up significantly the closer you are and the longer time you are within that space. And so it is a gradient. We have to set some sort of bar or standard to do that. But we all know that it's not a perfect measure.
Before we move into something else, I just want with you isolated and doing telemedicine for 14 days and other healthcare providers in the community also not being online to work, do you see a potential problem in our local community with having enough healthcare providers within the next couple of weeks? I mean, if you're not able to go in and do in-person stuff, are we reaching a point where that's going to become a problem?
The reality of it is that whoever is not a close contact, whoever is cleared, is going to pick up the slack. I mean, that's the way it is going to end up being. There may come a period here where it's like going back to residency, where we're doing very long hours, and whoever's got they're able to keep their feet on the ground is going to keep moving forward, and those who can't are going to support as best they can from home.
Now, is patient.
And I think to add to that is that, you know, we have not been. To add to that, it's been interesting. The like in other parts of the country that have become more desperate, you even hear of places where they're sending medical providers or nurses that actually have COVID in to actually provide care to patients that have COVID. Now, that is like an extreme place where we don't want to be. But like, you know, I think that there are places in the country where somebody who's a close contact like I am would be kind of forced to go back into work. And that's problematic. But, you know, if there is too much work to be done with other, you know, with the providers that are left, then that is needing to be done. So I think that getting to a desperate point like that is not where we want to be. But I think that there would be ways that we would have to figure that out.
Got a question here about what is the best way to keep businesses and schools open?
Yeah, I think we're going to go back to the same old things that I frankly don't argue with people about masks very much, just because it seems like people have made up their mind. But I will still continue to preach that the best way to keep schools and businesses open is by wearing a mask and kind of delaying the big social gatherings until this passes. I think we're closer to the finish line. It's still a long haul, but we're at least closer to the finish line than we were. We can see that immunizations are going to start being given within the next month, and it's going to be a long process before we're able to immunize everybody who even wants to be immunized. It's going to take some time, but this will cut down on the transmission. There's a lot of questions about the immunizations still, as far as does it actually prevent disease spread? Can you be a carrier even if you've had the immunization? I think it's unlikely. I think you're going to have a good immune response to it, but a lot of these factors are unknown. We do know that it's about 95% effective, especially for symptoms in particular. There is a lecture from the CDC this morning for Alaskan providers online that starts paving the way for what we're going to do in the future with immunizations and how we're going to select who gets it first and what's the reasoning behind it.
Well, now that we have news that the
I guess I would chime in and say, I guess I would chime in and say also, just to echo even, you know, how do we keep businesses and schools open? Well, it takes all of us doing all the right things pretty much all the time. And I think that there's just not a lot of wiggle room for not wearing masks, for doing mass gatherings, especially when you start to see the virus, you know, in significant prevalence in our community. The vigilance has to increase, and doing things like small things, you know, when you're going out to a restaurant, maybe doing the takeout route, you know, not going into the restaurant, wearing masks, like you said, when you're out in public, making sure that you're wearing masks, but also keeping distance, you know, and then we talked, I know that you guys talked a bit about it, you know, things leading up to the holidays, but we're in the holiday season. There's lots of, you know, gatherings and friends and family get together, and, you know, we've got to love each other by being apart this holiday season. It's the way it's going to have to be in order for, us not to get in a bad spot and, or in a worse spot, I should say. And, so those are some of the things that I think we have to do in order to be able to keep kind of general businesses. I'm really afraid that we're heading more towards a lockdown. We talked about in the spring, the hammer and the dance. You know, we put the hammer down in March, April, and May, and then we've been dancing since then. But I'm afraid that, you know, we're not dancing in the right direction right now. And so I think that we could be headed towards more significant shutdowns, which is not what any of us want to see.
Unless it's universally practiced, though, would it make any difference? You know, unless there was some teeth to the lockdown, if you have a consistent message that this is what's necessary, but a significant portion of the population doesn't practice those good protocols, what difference does it make in the long run? And doesn't it just appear we're heading for a train wreck?
I mean, I do not want to discount the efforts by individuals to make a difference. And I don't think we should discount the fact that individuals make individual decisions, and those decisions do matter. You know, there's cases, you know, of, you know, a family gathering or a gathering of friends that ends up putting grandma in the hospital, and grandma ends up dying from it. And had they chosen, that individual family chosen not to do that, then that would not have happened. And so I think that it gets easy to talk about all these numbers. You know, a person in the U.S. is dying from coronavirus every hour, you know, every hour of every day this last week. And I can't, you know, you can't, it's hard to put that in perspective and to say that those are just numbers, but those are people. And so I think that I agree. If everybody's compliant from a community-wide perspective, it's going to help. And it's going to help us continue to keep these structures in place, schools, businesses, doing these things that are kind of normal for our society. But I don't want that to dissuade people that are making individual decisions for their family and for their friends. You know, those are important decisions to make individually. Sure, I wish that there was probably stronger community buy-in or buy-in, you know, but I think that all you have control of is yourself. And so you just need to make good decisions. You know, those are the decisions you can control.
Got a question here from somebody who wants to know if there is something a person at home can do to help with contact tracing.
So, I keep coming back to these two forms from the state of Alaska. They're with the forms from the state of Alaska. One of them has, like, on the back of it an area that defines what a close contact is, and it has you kind of look out and write them down, your close contacts from the last few days before your test. So from an individual perspective, yes, there would be things you could do if you were tested positive and you could contact trace. The state of Alaska, I know, does have a program where people can get trained to be contact tracers through the state of Alaska. And so I don't know all the details of that. Perhaps you could find out more. I don't think you need to be a nurse. Initially, it was only nurses, but I think that that's actually happened a little bit. But there are ways that people can be trained to be contact tracers. But I don't have all the specifics on that.
I'm going to ask you kind of a big question, which is the difference in terminology between effectiveness and efficacy. They seemingly are being used interchangeably when we're talking about vaccines, but there's definitely a difference between how they're used. Can you explain that?
It's tough to differentiate between the two. Effectiveness is the overall performance of how it's going to work in our community. Efficacy is typically on an individual basis. So the efficacy in these controlled studies where we give 25,000 people this immunization and 25,000 people get the placebo, we can measure efficacy. Then when we look at effectiveness, we say, all right, now we're going to roll this vaccine out. And we know it has a 95% efficacy rate. How effective it is it going to be when only 25 or 50% of people are willing to take the vaccine? And so the effectiveness is what is it going to be in the real world versus what is it going to be in a controlled setting where we can control all the different variables a little bit better. With this vaccine, there's other factors that we still have to work out as far as even efficacy. And that's the great news about these vaccines is they did look at it in populations that are typically harder to vaccinate, such as those 65 or older, and it's very effective. But the areas that we don't know are, for instance, pregnant and breastfeeding moms. That population has been excluded from the studies up to this point. And I'm not sure how it's going to be addressed in the future, but we know that that pregnancy does confer a higher risk with COVID, but are we supposed to be vaccinating those people or not? So efficacy is in the ideal situation. Effectiveness is when we actually dump it into the real world and see how it works in a community.
Right, because those numbers for the vaccines or the trials that they were releasing in regards to all of them, two of them were 90-95%, one of them was 70%, but if you gave people alternate doses, it would go up to 90%. And then you find out that the group of people that were tested for the vaccines doesn't include a lot of these subgroups, which you as a medical provider are going to have to give people advice on whether or not to take. That's a good question. I mean, if the vaccine is available to a pregnant mom, would you recommend the person getting it? If somebody's a cancer survivor or currently has cancer, do you tell that person that it's safe to take the vaccine? Those are all the things that are down the road, I guess. But the good news, at least, is that, you know, it looks like maybe within a week or two.
I don't think that we have those answers yet. I think that there's going to be, you know, some pretty significant developments in those areas coming up. You know, even just talked about how there was a little bit of a webinar this morning by kind of one of the heads of the CDC. In regards to this, who was talking about it, that there's probably more evidence in some of these subgroups than we are aware of at this point. Those numbers are still being crunched. These are ongoing trials. And so I'm sure that there's going to be more information that comes out in the coming weeks and months that is not currently available.
Well, let's talk about the good news about the vaccine, at least that, you know, the UK approved its use today for the first one. It looks like that's probably going to be approved by this FDA here next week in America with a second one and maybe a third one coming online. So I know in Alaska, there's the wheels are spinning to start passing out anywhere between 5,000 and 20,000. Is that's the first numbers I think we're looking at, right?
I haven't heard any specific numbers on this. The discussions we've had is, you know, who are we going to give it to first? I mean, who has the priority? Is it the frontline workers, those working on ambulance crews, ERs, things like that? Or is it people who are high risk to having a bad outcome, such as those living in like senior homes and stuff like that? That's the discussions that's been happening so far. And it looks like we're going to try to push through a lot of people who are first line workers first, because they're at the greatest risk of spreading it to others.
Well, and we also need you. We need you working. I mean, I guess, you know, this is always one of those ethical discussions. The ACIP had their meeting yesterday and came out with national protocols of, you know, who's going to get it first with healthcare providers and people in long-term care at the top of the list, and then sort of chaining it down to other essential workers after that. But if we only have a limited amount that comes into Alaska and then it's distributed by population into communities here, then do you then at a local level here have to participate in a discussion about which one of you doctors and which one of the nurses in town gets it first if you only have a limited supply?
Well, I know that there is a lot of work being done on this in our community, in our state. As far as I'm not necessarily sitting at the table where these discussions are happening, so I can probably only speak kind of it in vague details on it. But I do know that there is a lot of work being done locally to help with coordinating vaccine administration, to do it in very an organized way. So I don't have that answer to your exact question, but I know that there's a lot of work being done on that. And some of that's coming down from a national level and statewide level. And some of it is going to be able to be administered from the community level, but I'm not sure how that all that decision-making fits.
Okay. Well, let's just put you in the room. If the vaccine was made available to you in our community right now, you know, and we only had enough to vaccinate 10 doctors, would you be one of the ones that would stick your hand up first and say, I trust it, give it to me?
I know that I've said it in the past that I'm willing to be one of the people vaccinated. There's a lot of people, even in the medical community, who are unsure how they feel about this. I'm willing to be vaccinated. I don't feel like I have to be first in line if there's others who need it more than me, such as folks working in the ER, folks working on ambulance crews who may have a higher chance of being exposed than I am. I'm at the point, I think almost everybody in town who's in the medical profession is treating everybody they come across as somebody who is positive for COVID. Otherwise, the exposure is going to continue to go up. And so I have changed my mentality where I'm wearing the uncomfortable mask because of that. But if there's others in the community who need it ahead of me, I'm fine with that. I don't really care, but I'm happy to take the vaccine.
I think I would echo what Eben said. Based on, you know, the safety profile that's been studied thus far and the effectiveness of it, like I said, I might not be you know, trying to cut people off in line, but I think that I'd certainly be willing to take it.
No, I guess that's the question I was getting at, sort of, is the ability of people to step back and make it available to people that they think need it more than they do. I mean, we would think as a, personally, I would think, it'd be very important to get to the medical care providers so that you're all vaccinated, so that you can all continue working while we get ourselves in a position where everybody in the community can be vaccinated. But the question is then, do you people feel like that's something you would innately do, is say, you know, I'm young, I'm healthy, I don't think that I'm going to get it, I'll pass the vaccine that's available on to somebody else?
I don't know if we're going to have a choice in some of these things. I think there are going to be some mandates coming down to medical providers saying that we're required to have a flu shot. And this may be a requirement through some of the organizations that if you're going to work in the hospital, if you're going to work in the clinic, that you need to have the vaccination. And so I think that choice may be taken out of our hands. I think all of us as physicians I do, frankly, when I hear medical groups saying, well, our number one priority is the safety of our workers. Well, that's not true, because we as medical providers put ourselves in harm's way knowingly on a regular basis. When we see sick patients, it's not our number one priority. Our number one priority is our patients in many ways. And so we protect ourselves. But I think it's hard for me to take a vaccination ahead of somebody who is not as healthy as me. But I think that choice may be taken out of our hands.
Something that Dr. Zink said yesterday was really quite stunning to me, in that a question came to her about whether or not the vaccine could be mandatory. And because of the way that this has been moved through the FDA with an emergency allowance, that it can't be mandated, that we can't make people take this, which is kind of probably consistent with American philosophy anyway. There aren't really mandates for vaccines, are there? I mean, it's just good practice, but nobody's required to take a vaccine, are they, unless it's a condition of a job or a school or something like that, where
I don't think anyone's going to be held down and forced to have a vaccination given to them. But the schools may require it, just like they require many vaccinations already. Your place of work may require it for you to work there. There's not going to be people knocking on your door trying to vaccinate you. I cannot imagine. It's just that some places in high risk areas, such as in the medical field, I think they're going to ask that we get vaccinated. That would be my guess.
I got to close this week, but I apologize for this, technical issues that we've had. This has not been a free flowing discussion like normal. So let's try and get the bugs ironed out by next week. I did have a question about, is there a way to find out which age group is getting it the most? And I know that the Alaska site actually has a list of all the people that have had it, and it pretty much breaks down to, it's pretty equally distributed from people under 10 all the way to over 70. It looks like the numbers are, you know, 30 people under 10 have had it, 56 in teenagers, 82, 20 to 30-year-olds, 90, 30 to 40-year-olds, 70, 40 to 50-year-olds. The numbers are all kind of the same. Is that what we're seeing locally in Kodiak, that the people who come in and test positive are from a broad spectrum of ages? And
so it may be different with what Curtis has seen, but what I have seen is it seems like it's the 30 to 50 year old who bring it into the home, and then the kids get it from mom or dad. That's typically what I've seen. It's actually not been the schools that I've seen much transmission in. It's not the kids going to school and passing it to one another. It's frankly, I see more 30 to 50 year olds bringing it into the home. And once it's in the home, then it does affect the younger kids, and it kind of broadens out that age spectrum.
Have we seen infections in the 60 to 70 year old population? You know, the group that seems to be at the highest risk.
We're definitely seeing more of that now. You know, I don't think we've seen much of that until more recently. And again, this is kind of worrisome, because we do know those are folks that are more likely to get more severely ill. And so I think, it is worrisome when we see older people test positive, but I've definitely seen more of that in the last few weeks than I have in the months leading up to this.
Well, it's still stunning when we think about, with the death rate in the United States, that 40%, almost 40% of them are people coming out of long-term care facilities. You know, that's just a fairly stunning number. So I think that's why there's probably such a scramble to try and get the vaccine into those communities as well as to the healthcare providing communities as fast as they possibly can. Now, what if somebody already has COVID, does the vaccine actually do anything for them?
I think that this is one of those unanswered questions. The question is, if somebody has it actively, the vaccine doesn't do probably much for them. I think that that's pretty safe to say. The question is that if people have had COVID, how durable is that immunity? How long does that immunity last? And then the secondary question is the durability of immunity from the vaccine better? Are people more protected by the vaccine than they are by if they've had an active infection? And I don't think we know that yet. It does seem like from a biologic perspective, the immune response, the antibodies that people make to the vaccines is higher than that people make from an active infection. And they do seem to last longer, but how that behaves in real life as far as preventing infection, we don't know.
Well, guys, we are going to put it to a close there. I'm going to work on a different platform next week so that we have maybe a little smoother transition and we can talk to each other and without these long delays next week. So Dr. Smith had to go back to the ER, which is why he dropped off the call. It wasn't a technical thing, but good luck in your quarantine there, Curtis, and even best of luck in the week ahead as we wait for the Thanksgiving surge, if one comes. Hopefully it doesn't come, but stay tuned tomorrow afternoon for an update from the local EOC, and I think we're planning on maybe having them come in sometime this week for a follow-up as things sort of progress in our community. So thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Send in your questions for next week, and we'll try and have a
All right, thanks
show.
For having us.
Okay. All right. Have a good day. Thank you.